She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I am so fortunate because week after week, we really give you an opportunity to think about a lot of really important things about preservation of this great planet of ours. Thanks for joining us today. We, as always, like to give a shout out to our sponsors. We greatly appreciate them. And a special thanks today goes to the sponsor of this show, the Fairfax Companies. Their dedication to improving the environment through creative and innovative business practices is why Fairfax is the leader in the business of sustainability, and indeed they are. They're up to all kinds of different things every time I visit them. Our guest today is Dana Gunders. She is a return guest to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. She is a project scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council, among other things, many things, and author of an issue paper called Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. Obviously a topic of great interest to Mrs. Green. Dana, welcome to Mrs. Green's World again. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited, and I just want to do a quick shout out to everybody. A thank you, because we're doing a Kickstarter, and we're about 3 weeks into it. We're very close to reaching our goal. It's called What Am I Eating and Why Should I Care? It all starts with your fork. And I want to say, if we get 500 backers and we're over halfway there and reach our goal of $25,000, we'll get a $5,000 match from a private foundation, which we will put to good use, probably producing more shows on food and why everything really does start with your pork. Your fork, there's a little slip there. Don't start with your pork. This is a very important venture for us, and we hope you'll check it out. You can go to my website at mrsgreensworld.com and see the little click in the upper right-hand corner. Make a pledge and help us pass the finish line. Now, let's get started. And Dana, I called you a little bit ago because the comprehensive the magnitude and scope of your paper and of the issue itself is incredible. So I figured a great place to start is for people who are not familiar with the NRDC, just give us a little background of its big mission.
Sure, happy to. NRDC is kind of one of the nation's big environmental organizations, and we just celebrated our 40th anniversary. Wow. We work on issues all the way back through the establishment of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And today we cover everything from wildlife to air, water, energy, climate, and food. And I work in our food and agriculture program.
And you cover the Clean Beach Report. Don't you do that every year? I've had guests on the show for that, about what's happening with the beaches. So it's really like long-term studies, but very topical.
We sure do. That's okay. Right. And some of our initiatives do. It takes some things in this world take a while to change.
Yeah, no kidding. And some things are getting worse and some things are getting better. And we try to focus on what's getting better. So let's give a little bit more foundation on, this was a comprehensive study on food waste. Why the decision to study that and kind of lay the foundation? I think we could talk about the first paragraph and the statistics in the first page of the report. So if people want to just see that, it'll give you enough to think about. So just give us a little bit of background about why this initiative and foundation work.
Well, I actually stumbled across these waste numbers when I was working on a project with the fruit and vegetable industry.
You are kidding me.
And the project was to look at on-farm sustainability. So we were looking at air and water and energy use, and I was charged with coming up with a way to measure waste on farm, and that had me looking at the numbers, and I started reading over materials and seeing these numbers that were so staggering for me that I couldn't believe they were true, because I figured if these numbers are true, people would be talking about it. There's no way this is not true. And some of the numbers that we're talking about are that 40% of the food in this country never gets eaten.
Just right there. Just right there. 40%. I ask people all the time, because I heard you talk in New York, how much do you think of our food is wasted? Nobody says 40%.
It's astonishing. And particularly when you think of what an investment food is for us as a country. We invest 80% of our water, half of our land area, and 10% of our energy to producing food. Well, we're not eating that ultimately. It's just a terrible use of those resources, no matter how sustainably or organically we're growing it.
And then talk about the dollar value, because that's a huge number. And it's, like I said, if people just want to go to, you know, nrdc.org/foodfiles, and then they can do a search, it's easy, but it's files/wastedfood. Some people like to look when they're on, you know, listening. But talk about how many billions of dollars each year is lost in food waste.
Sure. And if you just Google NRDC food waste, you'll be able to find the report, no problem.
Yep.
Well, the USDA estimates that this is costing our economy about $165 billion between the losses that are experienced at retail and through our restaurants and food service and in our households altogether. What that means for the average family of four is that somewhere between about $1,300 to $2,200 a year is being spent on food that ultimately never gets eaten. So it's real money we're talking about here.
It's real money. But does it start with, is there a way to quantify where the biggest loss is? Because doesn't some of it, what significant part of that number comes from just food that comes off of trees or that's on the land and just stays there and rots because it isn't the right size or it fell before the harvesters came? How significant is that loss?
It's fairly significant. You know, I mean, this problem is definitely a multi-headed beast.
Right.
And we haven't been studying it for very long, and we don't have great data to really be able to say, you know, X percent is happening here versus there. But the really high-level estimates are that about 20, for fruit and vegetables, about 20% of the losses are happening on farms. And part of the reason for that is that we are just very picky about what our fruits and vegetables look like. And there's other reasons, too. You know, they vary in prices dramatically, and so farmers are sometimes left in a situation where they've grown a crop, they're ready to harvest it, but the price is so low that they can't even recover the cost of harvesting it in order to get it off the field and to the market.
And, you know, it's okay, so there's the $165 billion a year with uneaten food when we have world hunger crisis, and it rots in landfills. In this paper, it says it's the single largest component of U.S. solid waste. Well, then it turns into a large portion of methane emissions. So it's like the chain just keeps getting worse.
So, it's true.
Go ahead.
Food is the number one contributor to our landfill and our waste streams today. And it does, when it gets into landfills, it does, it rots and creates methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's 25 times more powerful than CO2. In fact, the United Nations came out with a report after ours that estimated that if food waste were a country, it would rank third in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions.
Oh, my God. You are kidding.
After U.S. and China.
Oh, my God.
Now, that includes, you know, all of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with producing food, so fertilizer production, fertilizer use that can interact with our soils and create greenhouse gases. Meat production is a huge part of that, and then also the methane that comes from it when it's not used.
So going from the feeding people issue, going to that from the waste and the methane gas and on, I think there are lots of people that are listening to think, well, we're so lucky, hardly anybody goes hungry in America. Can you shoot the hole in that myth? Because it's a big myth.
Yes, and absolutely. This is not just an environmental problem. Today in the U.S., one in six Americans is what they call food insecure, which means that at some point during the year, at least, they don't have a secure supply of food coming to their tables. So for those people, you know, it's not that we're able to necessarily take all of the food we're wasting and plop it on their plates, but there are opportunities to rescue some of it, and it's certainly a tragedy to have the enormous levels of waste that we do existing alongside, you know, this hunger problem.
It's like, wake up. There are lots of, and I always like to say, there are really hungry kids going to bed every night, and there is a huge way to help have an impact on that by just looking at a small part of recovering some of the food waste. What about when people say, we can't afford it? I mean, it's cheaper to let it rot. Can you make the case for why this is such a great triple bottom line solution that will end up making money and helping consumers and, you know, helping to businesses to be more profitable?
Yeah, in some ways you can, and in some ways you can't.
Okay.
That's really the truth. Certainly for us as consumers, you know, there's no doubt that when you go to the store and you buy, you know, a $10 a pound chunk of salmon and you only use 3/4 of it and you put it in leftovers and you don't get around to eating it, you know, that's $2 to $3 you just threw out. And when you compound that over the course of the year, it does add up to real dollars. And we're so careful when we're in the store about pennies, you know, 5 cents can shift us from one brand to another.
Right.
And yet when we come home, we stop counting that and we don't really register that we're throwing dollars out with our food.
And what about things like eating out? I mean, to me, when you talk about making a difference right in your own, as you know, if you're from back east, you might say pocketbook. Out here, they say purse. but if you go out to eat, sharing and taking food home and making another meal out of it. To me, like when we go to a restaurant and you're served a portion that's like disgusting, enough for three people to eat a full meal, well, we're happy because we take it home and we make two more meals out of it. Is that one of the ways that you can, you know, we can point to people and say, hey, folks, this is good. This is really a good thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's some sort of teamwork to be had between restaurants and their consumers in terms of reducing food waste. They're giving us enormous portions. And part of that is consumers have come to equate value with quantity, right? So, you know, you
yes.
get this huge plate of spaghetti for your $8 and you're really happy. You don't need to eat all that spaghetti, you know? It's probably not a good thing if you do, in fact. And so taking it home is a good answer, you know, when you're in that situation. I also would like to see restaurants offering smaller portions, you know, perhaps at a discount, offering sides a la carte so that if you don't want that huge scoop of potatoes with your omelet, you don't have to get it. And also I think doing away with split plate charges that discourage just what you're mentioning, where you can go and actually share.
I find that just really annoying, and I always pay it, but it's like, really, you're going to wash one plate? You know, and I want restaurants to succeed and have a really good bottom line, but that is really a good idea. It's like, I'm like, really? You're going to charge me $5 to use another plate? And it increases to so many things like obesity and on and on and on. So let's talk about where does, I like to do the global view because you did really speak a lot to what some other countries are doing. What is the U.S. doing? I mean, I want to circle back to that, but in terms of food waste, are you seeing a national spotlight? Do you think grassroots efforts are happening fast enough to focus on this with restaurants and consumers and Know Your Farmer and, you know, the beat goes on, food production people?
Mm-hmm. I do. You know, our report first came out about 18 months ago, and at that time there was a lot less discussion, and I've observed the conversation just really skyrocketing since then. I mean, it's really, I think, grown in the consciousness and minds of people. And just being aware, I mean, the great thing about this challenge is that just awareness, I think, can take the first bite out of the problem. Because as soon as you start thinking about food that you're wasting, you really see it more. You know, this is something that has that everyone seems to care about, and it's just kind of gone under our radar for some time now. But as soon as you start talking to people about it, they go, yeah, yeah. And those same people get into their homes and make some better decisions. And same thing, at, you know, when they're at the grocery store. And I think just that awareness is actually going to make a big difference. You know, is it happening fast enough? Well, really, to turn this thing around, we're going to need a paradigm shift about food and respecting it and seeing it as something that really shouldn't be wasted. And I think we're a long way from that paradigm shift, but these things take a while. And certainly, we're hearing and seeing a lot of attention to the topic nowadays.
Well, one of the things I loved, and again, it's like I really did read a lot of the fine print. One example that you highlight that I want you to tell about is baby carrots, because the first time I read that, I knew this, but tell everybody about those cute little tiny baby tender carrots they're buying for the most part.
Sure. Well, the history.
They're not.
They're not nowadays. The origin of those baby carrots was a carrot farmer who was just sick of throwing out his bent and funny-shaped carrots. And I don't know, for the gardeners out there, if you've had that experience, but I know I grow carrots, and I have yet to grow a single carrot that would actually pass muster in a grocery store. I mean, they're always, like, bent, or they look like W's or something.
They're pretty ugly. They're pretty ugly, but they're delicious.
Exactly. So this guy got sick of, you know, throwing those away and sending them to cattle feed or whatever he was doing, and it kind of had an idea when he was cutting them up for his daughter one night that he would take those big carrots and cut them up and sell them up as pre-cut carrots. And then he came up with a cute name, like Bunny Carrots, and started selling them. And eventually wound up selling them for, you know, a better price per pound than his regular carrots. And that goes on today, that some of the warped carrots out there do now feed into that baby carrot industry. Although it's gotten so sophisticated, you now have, you know, specs, as they call them, for the baby carrot, the processing carrots that go into baby carrots as well.
And anybody who has ever been to a farm, even when you buy a bag of carrots, you buy those cute little homogenized, pretty packaged, fits on the, you know, the crudité plate for your ranch dip. It's like, stop and think. They're fake. They're not fake, but they don't grow like that.
Right. They don't grow like that. And you know, we, after we did the report that you're mentioning, we actually did a survey of farmers to get a better sense of what is leading to losses on farms. And, you know, this idea about the cosmetics and the fact that not every fruit or vegetable grows the right size and shape to fit in the box perfectly, to, you know, make the two-week trip that it has to make and stay fresh the whole time. That is leading to, you know, a good portion of the waste. Sometimes 20-30% of a given crop is not making it to the store for that reason.
And, you know, sometimes I think it's, you know, I feel very blessed because I got to spend time on a friend's farm up in Oregon, and they have a very small farm. It's like 22 acres, you know, big enough. And they have pears and cherries, and pretty much that's pears and cherries. It's up in around Hood River. And just the amount of pears that were on the ground before the pickers came, because when you have to harvest, you have to harvest. I mean, Dana, it blew me away. Not everybody can go to a farm and see that, but we couldn't all work fast enough to pick it up, because this is a conscientious farmer, to give it away, take it to farm stands, you know, make things of it. I mean, a bucket of pears weighs a ton, and it was just falling down, and a lot of it was going to rot no matter what we did. I mean, it's really labor intensive to prevent that piece.
true. And in fact, labor shortages are one key reason why farmers are unable to harvest their crops sometimes.
Okay, it blows me away.
Just last year, there was a labor shortage up in Washington that left about 25% of the apple harvest unharvested.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, let's talk about how the American consumer consumes as opposed to some other comparison in the country. We'll be right back. Dana Gunders, NRDC. Please stay here with me. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative. Our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love. Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange. Sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we're certainly giving you a lot to think about today. I am very pleased to have as our guest Dana Gunders, a project scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and she is the author of an issue paper called Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. And everybody, I just want to do a shout out about this paper. It is not a heavy duty, hard to read scientific journal, even though it is incredibly substantive. So don't be daunted by the scientific, you know, title. Dana, you did an eloquent and amazing job of making it so relatable to mainstream, which to me is what we need to do more. It's not reading through pages and pages of, uninteresting data. I'm sorry to say that. It really grabbed me. So I encourage people to go to NRDC or even Google food waste, and I think Dana's name will come up. So thanks for that. I want to make sure people take a look because there's so much more than we'll be able to cover today.
Thanks for that.
And I mean it. It's like it's really a good thing for all of us to be aware of, and the consumer, the awareness starts with us. So how do we consume versus someone in Southeast Asia? Let's give that, because that's one of the things you highlighted. It's pretty mind-boggling.
It's true. Yeah. Well, certainly at the consumer level here in the U.S., the average American wastes about 10 times more than a consumer in Southeast Asia. So it's quite dramatic. And, you know, when you look at the differences of where food is being lost and in a developed country like the U.S. versus a place like Southeast Asia, it's quite dramatic. You know, there they have almost the same amount of losses, but a lot of it is happening between the farm and the market. And so, you know, you can picture a truck of tomatoes on a hot, bumpy road, you know, that's not paved, and the truck breaks down and it's not refrigerated, and a lot of the fresh product is just not making it to market because they don't have the infrastructure that we have here. And yet when it gets there, the consumers are very careful to use all of it. And we sort of have the opposite situation here, where we're very efficient at getting our product to market, with the exception of some of the things we just talked about how we're choosy and leaving it on the field. But then once we get it as consumers and even as restaurants, it can go to waste often.
So when you make that comparison, is there that need for the pretty perfect tomato and the shiny bright apple, 90% sure, genetically modified, probably 99%, lots of them modified to be pretty and look nice and fit on the shelves and ship easily. So does that same, sexy food factor apply in countries throughout the world, or is it the Americans that want everything to look pretty?
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's certainly a kind of developed country problem. You know, Europe does it as well. They have quite beautiful produce on their shelves, and we do here in the U.S. But it's certainly, if you go to a street market in India, not what you wouldn't only find perfectly straight carrots and perfectly shiny apples. So it is a luxury, really, to be that picky.
And if you go and see, if you frequent food, local farmers markets and educate yourself, some of the ugliest heirloom tomatoes taste the best. They're freaky looking. They're weird shaped and they're delicious. You want to eat every part except the stem. So you educate yourself about pretty does not translate to delicious.
That's right. And, I think the way that people shop at farmers markets really illustrates that we have much higher tolerance as consumers for things that are funny shaped than stores give us credit for. Because these days, you're hard put to find something that's funny shaped in a store, or even something that's small. I mean, sometimes it's not just the shape, but the size. Like, I don't know about you, but when I go to a regular grocery store, I'm always surprised by how big the apples are. And I love apples, but I can't eat these giant apples that you find in a store today. And, those smaller ones just aren't even making it to the shelf. They're probably, with the case of apples, being used as apple juice or applesauce or something. But I'd like to see smaller apples on the shelf myself.
Or even rotting. I mean, that's what the part that scares me. So they're either being made to applesauce or all of those things. So in one of the sections of the report, you talk about efficiency losses in our food system. And I'd like to just get a little bit specific, because the losses in farming, production losses are the greatest for fresh produce. And you say that meat, seafood, and dairy have different issues that aren't discussed in the paper. But talk about the two things, and I think we covered it, between how much of the food is never harvested and food that is lost between harvest and sale. How significant are those two steps?
Well, I think for fresh produce, it's sort of this idea that we've been talking about where,
right,
sometimes some of it gets pulled out because of its cosmetics. Other times it does go down to some of the contracts that are drawn up or not drawn up between farmers and their retail customers, the grocery stores, and some of the terms of those. And then other times it's just the pricing. And so there are these market dynamics that I think are somewhat out of the control of any individual farmer, but ultimately there are some ways that businesses can be more efficient. I think, again, it's kind of either designed in because we're picky and we're creating specs that really only select certain types of products, or just some of it has to do with just our large system here and the way that businesses feel like they have to work because they are so big. When you look at our smaller local food systems, I think we do have somewhat less waste, or certainly the opportunity to have less waste when we do have a local food system, because you have more direct relationships where a farmer is able to communicate with their customers and let them know that, hey, I have some tomatoes that got hailed on, but they'll make great sauce. Would you want them? And
right,
kind of have conversations like that.
Right. And when you go to, keep going, probably up the food chain a little bit, you have production costs, cost losses, transportation. And then what about when it comes to the losses in retail? Because all of the suppliers, whether it's the farmer's market or a big, huge grocery store or a little mom and pop grocery store, they have to buy based on use. But you can't hit that target all the time. How much are we losing in retail operation of this 40% loss? Or is there a number?
Of the 40%, I'm going to say at retail, it's fairly low in their actual stores, maybe 10% of the total.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit more. But there's a few things to note. I mean, first of all, our stores are, they're in a difficult position because we walk into a store and we expect to be able to get anything we want
Absolutely
at any time
right.
of day and have five choices, right? So those expectations are what they're reacting to. And they're very afraid of disappointing a customer and losing you to the store next door. And so they feel a lot of pressure to offer, to carry. And the average store carries about 50,000 different product lines just so that you can walk in there and have your choice. So that can lead to quite a bit of waste because, you know, for fresh products, they can't predict exactly what people will buy.
And even, I mean, in terms of food waste, I know one of the favorite things that I used to buy, and I don't anymore, is the rotisserie chicken. I mean, I read somewhere in the pages of your report that one grocery reported, I think, like 50% of their rotisserie chickens they had to throw away. Can't that go to a food bank or to some hungry kitchen? You know, it's like, whoa, why do you throw them away? There's hungry people down the street.
Yeah, that's such a hard example for me to swallow as well.
It is.
Those fresh foods, I mean, you see a lot of waste in the deli areas of grocery stores, and that's because they want to keep it fresh. And in fact, you know, in some cases, due to food safety requirements, they can only display it for a certain length of time. And the example that you're mentioning with the rotisserie chickens is that they typically have a four-hour limit to displaying those. And yet, you know, when they're done, some places will mark them down and try to sell them quickly, but others don't. And it's true that oftentimes they're not donated, and that really just depends on the store.
And like, I don't know, I think probably a lot with the community. I mean, you talk about New York is really a food island. And when I was there in September and I saw you, I mean, they're doing almost anything I could think of. There are groups that are organizing ways to, you know, harvest food waste. That's what I would call it, to make it go to another level. It's pretty impressive.
It is. And, you know, the other thing with that chicken example is that not all food waste is equal when you think of it in terms of nutrition
right.
or cost or environmental impact. You know, it takes a lot more to produce a chicken or a hamburger than it does a pound of carrots. In fact, when you throw out a hamburger, that's the equivalent in water use of taking a 90-minute shower.
Oh, my God. It's like, oh, God, you see that again. It's so awful. It's like the case for not eating hamburger. It's what's happening in the Mrs. Green's world for real. I just look at it and I think I can't do this anymore. So it's a very, very personal journey for me. What about sell-by dates? That is one that has always fascinated me. My niece has come to my house and looked at our salad dressings and said, Aunt Gina, like they're all so over with. And then there's like the guilt, but I think I don't believe this and they don't taste bad. What in them could go bad? Talk a little bit about sell-by dates because you did address that in your report.
Sure. You know, this to me is one of the easiest things to fix out there on this problem. The challenge is that most people don't actually understand what the expiration dates on food mean. Expiration dates, there are a couple different kinds, but none of them are actually talking about the safety of the food. So a lot of people will throw their food out thinking that it's bad on the date, when in fact, most dates out there are just suggestions for when the food is at its very best quality, but can often be eaten well after that.
And they shouldn't be thrown away. I mean, is it a marketing hype to get the consumers scared and throw it away and sell more of it? Or is it just for the suppliers, the food supermarkets to be safer so that nobody gets sick? Or is it a combination of all of those things?
You know, it's really, I think, for the brands, for the manufacturers, it's about assuring you quality and making sure that you experience their brand when they
right.
feel like it's at its best. And that's really what they're trying to convey to you with those dates, is this is when we think our brand is at its very best, but really not that you're going to get sick after eating it. Now, it depends what product we're talking about here, right? You're talking about your salad dressings.
Right.
Those are not going to make you sick when they're past their date. Now, if you're thinking about chicken, you want to make sure that you're cooking it really well.
Yes.
And right? So it does, and certainly, actually, the product to be most careful with are your deli meats that you don't cook. And that's really the product you probably do want to stick to a date. But most other products are fairly safe, and when in doubt, as long as you're cooking it, you'll be fine.
You know, it's so funny when you say that. I mean, I like to share my personal journey, but we used to just be deli people. We'd go on a picnic and go to the deli and buy, you know, fresh cold cuts. And the thought of that right now, it's like I don't even look at the deli counter because it's just, as in my opinion, as I evolve, it's like I have no idea what's in that. It's like it could be real food. Maybe it isn't real food, but I'm not so high on deli meats anymore, so I'm not worried about expiration dates. It's like, okay, I don't think I can do that. What about things like you see in the supermarkets, massive shopping carts filled with seasonal and holiday items that don't sell? What happens there? I mean, I would think if I ran Safeway, I'd have a pretty good idea on what my consumer pattern is going to be. Does that make up any significant piece of the loss of food that we're throwing away? Because I'm sure, well, ultimately, if you don't buy it on sale, it gets thrown in the garbage.
Sure. Well, certainly it's, a piece. And absolutely, where do the, sweet potato promotions go right after Thanksgiving? Or the avocados after Super Bowl. I was interested to learn that Super Bowl is the number one day for avocado sales in the country.
You are kidding.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
What happens after those, and certainly, Easter candy and all of these things that are very pinned to a particular day, a lot of those, if it's packaged food, it might wind up at a food bank. And it really depends on the store, but certainly it typically gets removed from the shelf pretty quickly and either gets tossed in the garbage or donated.
And just another thing that I read to just, I kind of want to make you chuckle because you know that I do my homework, but there are food products that are failures. I read that. I'm like, what the heck? So there's 19,000 new products. I think I made a note that are brought to the store shelves each year, and I'm thinking, what are there? Are we inventing new food? How can there be 19,000 new food products? We're not growing anything new. So how can you just talk about that a little bit? It's kind of like a fun one for me, of like, what? How could a product fail, and why would a grocery store buy them?
Yeah, and it's an astonishing statistic for me, too, because I can't quite think of what those are. I think
I
a lot of them are in the middle of the store, right?
Right, where we're not supposed to go.
The new Frosted Flakes that have, sprinkles on them or
Cocoa
whatever
Puffs.
It is. But it's true that, food companies are always trying new things. Consumers have demonstrated they like new and improved everything. So, of course, there's always the old standbys like Cheerios, but they are trying new products, and some of them do well, but a lot of them don't. And when they don't, they'll wind up, again, either donated or thrown away, or sometimes in one of these salvage stores that features those types of products.
It's really, I'm going to be looking. I am so going to be looking for new products and new promos because I don't really get it. Okay. We're going to take a break again. We have about a minute, but when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about what are some of your ideas since we probably didn't even get to page 4 of the report, which cracks me up, but it's all been very interesting. What kind of ideas do you have, or does the report address, for increasing the efficiencies in the store and out of store and retail? Should we come up with maybe 10,000 new products a year or something like that? It's like that one really got me, and really a lot. And I think it'd be great if you talked about ways. There's a little window you had in there about saving $100 million. Stop and Shop, how they saved it. So use an example of that. So when we come back, we have lots more to cover, everybody. And I'm sure you want to stay here with us because the one thing that we really do have all in common is we eat. It all does start with our fork. Our guest today is Dana Gunder. She's a project scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council and author of an issue paper, Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. Dana, when you come back, we'll cover that and anything else you think of on our short break that you really want to talk to, including a call to action. Everybody, please stay here with me. Time does fly when you're having fun.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine, it's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines, it gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
We rely on your generosity for our inventory. Homeowners, renters, contractors, and business owners keep the Habit Store stocked with building supplies, furniture, and appliances. You can drop off your donations or give us a call at 889-7200 to schedule a free pickup of items that are in good condition. Your donations means Habitat Tucson can build and renovate more homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And today, we're asking you to think about food waste, getting an incredible education, some shockers to me. Our guest today is Dana Gunder. She's a project scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council and author of an issue paper, Wasted, How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. Dana, thank you so much for being with us. And I'm laughing because time really does fly when you're having fun. And I get the 2-minute warning and I'm like, what? You've got to be kidding. That was like a 2-minute segment. So before we go into how we can improve efficiencies and what, you know, one example in the little window that you had in there about Stop and Shop saving $100 million, which is the triple bottom line, were there any other shockers that you want to talk to us about? 19,000 new kinds of food was so far the biggest shocker I think I found, other than that we throw away 40% of our food or waste it. Did you have any other shockers that you want to share with us that will make us sick or make us laugh?
I think my best shocker is about the average cookie, which has quadrupled in calories since the 1980s.
No way. That's awful.
And the thing about that, I mean, it's not about our grocery stores, although they're being sold there, right? But I remember, you know, selling cookies in my bake sales that were the right cookie size. And nowadays you go into Starbucks or even your grocery store and you find huge cookies. And, you know, there's only two things happening with those extra calories. Either we're eating them,
right,
which has its own issues,
right,
or we're not. Right, and it's going to waste.
And you know, that is such a good point because I feel the same way about muffins. When I would like a little muffin, and you look at the size of the muffins, and I don't want to pick on Starbucks, or I don't ever really want to pick on anybody. You look at the muffins there, and it's enough muffin for 4 days if you cut it in quarters. I mean, they're huge. Mm. So again, sharing, or not buying. And yet it ends up somewhere, and usually it's in a bigger pant size if you're going to keep buying those cookies. So we don't want to encourage that. It's the little carrots that we want to be getting everybody excited about. Okay, what about some ideas for increasing efficiencies in store? And talk to us about the Shop and Stop initiative. To me, that's really giving hope for how something can make a big difference.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, the CEO of Stop and Shop took a look, this was back in 2007, and really did an analysis of the fresh products in their store and why they were going to waste and how they could really improve their efficiency. And what he found was a few things. First, he found that they had these huge displays. You know, one thing, you go into a store, you'll see these piles of fruits and piles of vegetables and huge long salmons in the deli and all of that. And that's done because research has shown we like it, and we're more likely to buy things when we have this sort of appearance of abundance. And you know, what they found was that, sure, that might be adding to our desire to buy things, but it was also crushing the produce that was at the bottom of those piles, and it was leading things to rot, and that consumers who were experiencing that were actually not very happy. So what they did is they reduced the volume of products in their displays and found that that reduced waste quite a bit. They also narrowed down the choices. So instead of having, you know, a pack of tomatoes that had two, a pack that had four, a pack that had six, you know, some on the vine, some off the vine, they actually had about 25 different ways they were selling tomatoes. You know, they reduced that down to about 12. And it's something I think consumers barely even noticed, but it did allow the store to manage less inventory and have the products that they were buying kind of rotate quicker, which meant that the product that consumers were getting was actually fresher.
You know, I just think that you must have such a great sense of humor. We've talked about things before, but one of the quotes in that, and I have it, of course, pulled up on my screen, is the pile 'em high, watch 'em fly philosophy. It did not ring true. But the efficiency that you talked about, that I don't think the average consumer thinks about, is so there's a cost to even the waste other than having to throw it out and you bought it. Staff time. It's incredible. You have to get somebody to remove it from the shelves and put it away, and then it has to be transported away. So there's a whole ripple effect, not just, you know, here's some rotten tomatoes. It's for a big store owner, that's a big number.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so we don't want to watch them fly. So what are some of the other ideas that, not ideas, but the recommendations that, or ideas for increasing efficiencies in store and out of store retail? I think it's, you know, interesting to go through some of those.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think a real easy one is to start selling product that's near its expiration date at a discount.
Okay.
So a lot of stores will actually remove products 2 to 3 days before they're expired, and you'll never see them. Rather, they could mark them down, and some stores do this, some do it with some products, but it's certainly not done in a very standard way. And I think every store out there should be, you know, putting a sticker on anything that gets close to the date, or even just having a policy, right, and having the consumers do the work for them and finding product that's close to its date and, you know, giving a discount for that. And that would let us decide if it's okay, if we're okay with it or not, rather than assuming that we're not.
And everybody likes a bargain, too. I mean, it's, so there's that whole piece. You know, like you said there, buy one, get one free. I mean, or buy one, get the second one at half price. As a consumer, that stops me. I stop and look and see, how much can I save? I mean,
sure, I think...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Those buy one, get one free discounts, you know, and the way that stores do promotions are another challenge we have to deal with, because you might see the buy one, get one free on gallons of milk, and you only need 1 gallon, but there you are walking out of the store with two.
Oh my God, you're so right.
And you may not get to it in time. And so actually in the UK, where they've been looking at this issue a bit longer than we have, some of the stores are starting to move away from buy one, get one free and towards different types of promotions that are either buy one, get one later, or mix and match. So, you know, they'll have 3-4 different products, and they'll say, you know, buy any 3 of these at a discount, so that you're not stuck with more of something than you can really use.
Okay. So that's huge to me. It's like, and that's changing the mindset of how people purchase. And I'm sure there are very subtle, psychographic experts that are thinking about how to do this. It gets me really excited. What about, you talked a little bit about it, but to go into it some more, the losses in food service, because there's not just restaurants, there's cafeterias, there's fast food, there's caterers. How significant a player are they in terms of food waste?
They're very significant. I would say ultimately there's more food probably going to waste in the food service arena when you combine all those than at stores, at grocery stores. Directly. And it's everything from restaurants serving big portions and people not finishing those portions to, having to make something look very nice on the plate and throwing away kind of the rest of whatever that was.
Right.
To carrying really large menus and having to have all the inventory to make whatever it is that you order. So the Cheesecake Factory, for instance, is notorious for having, a 10-page menu or something, and they need to keep all that in stock so that in case you order it, they have it. And actually now, particularly in fine restaurants, we're seeing a move towards smaller menus, and I think that's really helped the efficiency of some of their kitchens because they don't need to carry quite as much varied inventory.
And I'm a former Jersey girl, and you go into a diner still in New Jersey, and there's an 8-page small print from Greek food to Italian food. Now that I've evolved, I think maybe not real food, but how do they do all that? Where do they even keep it in a diner? It's mind-boggling when you start really thinking about it. What about before we run out of time, what about food recovery and redistributing it for the poor and the hungry? How hopeful are you about that, and how can we start doing more about edible waste, recovering it and making it happen? What are some of the things that you think we can start doing and focusing on, and are you excited about it happening? That's like three questions, but I know you can handle it. You're a scientist. I can go one by one. Food recovery is the topic.
Yeah. I think overall, certainly food recovery is something that's been going on for a long time. Everything from our church kitchens that act as food pantries to, much bigger food banks that are out there. Still, there's only a limited amount of food that's being recovered, and there's huge, huge, huge opportunity to recover more of it. And certainly with the new interest in wasting less food, I do believe that a lot of the grocery store chains that are out there are trying to increase their efforts at donation. Really, it's kind of an afterthought for a lot of businesses. It's what you do at the end of the day when you realize you have some extra stuff. And I think if it's not woven into a business model for people, it gets very difficult because it is the end of the day. It's tired. You need that space for something you're doing the next day, for new products to come in. And so I think the trick is making sure it's very integrated. The other trick is making sure that the organizations that are recovering that food are reliable. And that means they need to be well staffed, with either volunteers or staff that are going to show up on time. Because as soon as a store or restaurant has an experience where a group doesn't come to take the food, they're really discouraged and are often ready to just drop the whole initiative.
And it's not worth it. I mean, you just see it in the groups that I'm in. We have, a buffet line in my Rotary every Thursday, and they're regulated, by city ordinances about if it sits X amount of time out, it cannot be packaged to go. I mean, so it's their hands are tied because of dangers of it being tainted in an hour, which really cracks me up. But those are some of inefficiencies that I wish we could get past. What role do you think the government should play or is playing or is not playing in terms of removing some of the efficiencies in the supply system? You talked about the UK, the European Parliament, and their food resolution, which is significant because they are going again. They're saying this is the European year against food waste. How are we doing?
Yeah, I think, you know, Europe showed real leadership in declaring 2014 the year against food waste and setting goals to reduce our food waste significantly. Here in the U.S., we're a little behind, I would say. Since our report came out in 2012, some things have changed. The USDA has declared a food waste challenge to the country, inviting businesses to set goals and to reduce their food waste, but there's not a whole lot of, resources being put behind that or real incentive for businesses to participate. Nevertheless, they do have, you know, a growing rank of businesses that are committing to food waste reduction in one way or another. Many of those commitments are around composting, and we haven't really talked about this distinction yet, but, you know, getting food out of landfills and into compost is a good thing. It's not nearly as good as, you know, stopping that waste from happening.
Right, not wasting it in the first place, right.
That's right. And so, you know, what we do see is a lot of effort going towards increasing diversion from landfills and composting or even making energy from the food scraps, less energy going towards preventing it in the first place.
And, you know, I say to people when we're talking about plastic bottles, they say, well, I recycle. And I say, just remember this, and it's not with judgment. The first R is reduce. That's a really smart wheel. Reduce, reuse, and the third R is recycle. So it's the same thing. It's the same mindset of the best thing we can do is reduce the waste in the first place. And the money it would save, the methane gases it would save, the transportation costs that it would save, it's mind-boggling. What do you think the average consumer can do? And this, you know, it might sound a little cliche, the firm grasp on the obvious, but people don't do it. So what can the consumer do to start changing it? Because from where I sit, we've got the power. We've got all the power because we're the ones that are buying it in the first place. So if we
Absolutely. So much we can do. And we can, you know, we can do it today when we get home, right? We can go through our fridge and take anything that is getting close to going bad and either pop it in the freezer, because I believe the freezer is a very underutilized part of our kitchen that can be put to work to save all sorts of things. You can really freeze almost anything. And it's always my savior when my life gets busier than I had planned and I'm not able to get around to cooking that thing I thought I would eat. So we can use our freezers more. We can get creative and really sort of shop our fridge before we go out to eat or before we go shopping. And I think probably the most critical thing is to be realistic when we're shopping, because so many times we have these aspirations when we're in the store, and yet our life happens when the week comes and we don't get around to that. And I think, you know, what I do is I only plan two meals a week right now in my life, and I leave the rest for either frozen food that I've popped in the freezer the week before, or that night I feel lazy and need to get takeout. So just, I think, being more realistic about what we're throwing away. And if you don't know what you're throwing away, try tracking it for a week or two and see. And if you notice that you're always throwing out lettuce, well, maybe, you know, buy a little bit less lettuce.
You know, I always work for the person I'm interviewing to say, oh, my gosh, that's a great question. Well, what I'm going to say is, oh, my gosh, that's a great answer, because that's really the truth. What's happened for us in our refrigerator, it feels so abundant and safe and wonderful to look in your refrigerator and it's full. Well, pretty much now our refrigerator is very, very empty, except for the freezer. Because we're buying fresher, it does require going to the grocery store sometimes more per week, but you can fit that in. So I think that is really a great answer. A stock full refrigerator probably means that you're overbuying, and we certainly did. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I think, you know, the opposite is a stock full freezer can really be liberating in that, you know, I buy a lot of frozen vegetables because fresh ones stress me out. And I know those frozen ones have actually, they're probably in the end fresher because they were frozen within just hours of being harvested.
It's a great, I mean, this is, I got the one minute signal. I don't like to call it a warning, but we're about to wrap up. Everybody, I hope you enjoyed the show and learned from it as much as I did. I hope it got you to think. I'm sure we did not tell you what to. Dana Gunders, thank you so much for being on our show. Next week, how appropriate. Gary Oppenheimer, founder, ampleharvest.org, someone who is doing something really big about food waste prevention all over the country. Make it a great, green, food waste-free week, everybody. Dana, thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care, everybody.